For several Sequanocean months, the two Hyperboreans were the honored guests of the quaint and worthy and virtuous people who called themselves the Blempfroims. Ibon had a real gift for languages and made progress in the local tongue far more readily than Morgai. His knowledge of the customs, manners, ideas, and beliefs of the Blempfroims soon became extensive, but he found it a source of disillusionment as well as of illumination. The armored monster that he and Morgai had driven before them so valiantly was, he learned, a domestic beast of burden that had strayed away from its owners amid the mineral vegetation of the desert lands adjoining Vlor, the chief town of the Blempfroims. The genuflections with which Ibon and Morgai had been greeted were only an expression of gratitude for the safe return of this beast, and were not, as Ibon had thought, an acknowledgment of the divine names he had quoted in the fearsome phrase, Iqui Dlosh Odklonk. The being that Ibon had met by the lake was indeed the god Zilkoigunza, and there were dim traditions of Zothakwa in certain early myths of the Blempfroims. But this people, it seemed, were most regrettably materialistic, and had long ceased to offer sacrifice and prayer to the gods, though they spoke of them with a sort of distant respect and with no actual blasphemy. Ibon learned that the words Iqui Dlosh Odklonk doubtless belonged to a private language of the gods, which the Blempfroims no longer understood, but which, however, was still studied by a neighbouring people, the Yedims, who maintained the ancient formal worship of Zilkoigmunza and various related deities. The Blempfroims were indeed a practical race, and had few, if any, interests beyond the cultivation of a great variety of edible fungi, the breeding of large centipedal animals, and the propagation of their own species. The latter process, as revealed to Ibon and Morgai, was somewhat unusual. Though the Blempfroims were bisexual, only one female in a generation was chosen for reproductive duties, and this female, after growing to mammoth size on food prepared from a special fungus, became the mother of an entire new generation. When they had been well initiated into the life and customs of Vlor, the Hyperboreans were privileged to see the future national mother, called the Genquom, who had now attained the requisite proportions after years of scientific nourishment. She lived in an edifice that was necessarily larger than any of the other buildings in Vlor, and her sole activity was the consumption of immense quantities of food. The sorcerer and the inquisitor were impressed, even if not captivated, by the mountainous amplitude of her charms and by their highly novel arrangement. They were told that the male parent or parents of the forthcoming generation had not yet been selected. The possession of separate heads by the Hyperboreans seemed to lend them a remarkable biologic interest in the eyes of their hosts. The Blempfroims, it was learned, had not always been headless, but had reached their present physical conformation through a slow process of evolution, in which the head of the archetypical Blempfroim had been merged by imperceptible degrees with the torso. But, unlike most peoples, they did not regard their current stage of development with unqualified complacency. Indeed, their headlessness was a source of national regret. They deplored the retrenchment of nature in this regard, and the arrival of Ibon and Morgai, who were looked upon as ideal exemplars of cephalic evolution, had served to quicken their eugenic sorrow. The sorcerer and the inquisitor, on their part, found life rather dull among the Blempfroims after the first feeling of exoticism had worn off. The diet was tiresome, for one thing. An endless succession of raw and boiled and roasted mushrooms, varied at rare intervals by the coarse and flabby meat of tame monsters. And this people, though they were always polite and respectful, did not seem to be greatly awed by the exhibitions of Hyperborean magic with which Ibon and Morgai favoured them, and their lamentable want of religious ardour made all evangelistic endeavour a thankless task. And, being fundamentally unimaginative, they were not even duly impressed by the fact that their visitors had come from a remote, ultra-synchronosian world. "I feel," said Ibon to Morgai one day, "that the god was sadly mistaken in deigning to send this people a message of any sort." It was very soon after this that a large committee of the Blemphroims waited upon Ibon and Morgai, and informed them that after long consideration they had been selected as the fathers of the next generation, and were to be married forthwith to the tribal mother in the hope that a well-headed race of Blemphroims would result from the union. Ibon and Morgai were quite overcome by the proposed eugenic honour. Thinking of the mountainous female they had seen, Morgai was prone to remember his sacerdotal vows of celibacy, and Ibon was eager to take similar vows upon himself without delay. The Inquisitor, indeed, was so overwhelmed as to be rendered almost speechless, but with rare presence of mind the sorcerer temporized by making a few queries anent the legal and social status which would be enjoyed by Morgai and himself as the husbands of the Genquam. And the naive Blemphroims told him that this would be a matter of brief concern, that after completing their marital duties, the husbands were always served to the national mother in the form of ragouts and other culinary preparations. The Hyperboreans tried to conceal from their hosts the reluctance with which they both regarded the coming honour in all its stages. Being, as usual, a master of diplomatics, Ibon went so far as to make a formal acceptance on behalf of himself and his companion. But when the delegation of Blemphroims had departed, he said to Morgai, "I am more than ever convinced that the god was mistaken. We must leave the city of Vlor with all feasible dispatch and continue our journey till we find a people who are worthier to receive his communication." Apparently it had never occurred to the simple and patriotic Blemphroims that the fathering of the next national litter was a privilege that anyone would dream of rejecting. Ibon and Morgai were subjected to no manner of duress or constraint, and their movements were not even watched. It was an easy matter to leave the house in which they had been domiciled, when the rumbling snores of their hosts were ascending to the great ring of Synchronosian moons, and to follow the highway that led from Vlor toward the country of Eudemes. The road before them was well marked, and the ring light was almost as clear and brilliant as full day. They travelled a long distance through the diversified and always unique scenery which it served to illumine, before the rising of the sun and the consequent discovery of their departure by the Blemphroims. These single-minded bipeds, it is likely, were too sorely perplexed and dumbfounded by the loss of the guests whom they had chosen as future progenitors to even think of following them. The land of the Eudemes, as indicated on an earlier occasion by the Blemphroims, was many leagues away, and tracts of ashen deserts, of mineral cacti, of fungoid forests and high mountains intervened. The boundary of the Blemphroims, marked by a crude sculpturesque representation of the tribal mother beside the way, was passed by the travellers before dawn. And during the following day they journeyed among more than one of those unusual races who diversify so widely the population of Saturn. They saw the Jebis, that Apteris and Stylitian bird people who roost on their individual dolomites for years at a time and meditate upon the cosmos, uttering to each other at long intervals the mystic syllables Yop, Yip, and Yup, which are said to express an unfathomed range of esoteric thought. And they met those flibbertigibbet pygmies, the Epiquis, who hollow out their homes in the trunks of certain large fungi, and are always having to hunt new habitations because the old ones crumble to powder in a few days. and they heard the underground croaking of that mysterious people, the Glongs, who dread not only the sunlight, but also the ring light, and who have never yet been seen by any of the surface dwellers. By sunset, however, Ibon and Morgai had crossed the domains of all the aforementioned races, and had even climbed the lower scarps of those mountains which still divided them from the land of Edims. Here, on the sheltered ledge, their weariness impelled them to halt, and since they had now ceased to dread pursuit from the Blemfroims, they wrapped themselves more tightly in their mantles against the cold, after a meagre supper of raw mushrooms, and fell asleep. Their slumber was disturbed by a series of cacodemoniacal dreams in which they both thought they had been recaptured by the Blemfroims and were forced to espouse the Jenquam. They awoke shortly before dawn from visions whose details were excruciatingly vivid and were more than ready to resume their ascent of the mountains. The slopes and cliffs above them were desolate enough to have deterred any travellers of inferior hardihood or less cogent fears. The tall woods of fungi dwindled ere long to tiny growths, and soon they lessened to forms that were no bigger than lichens, and after these there was nothing but black and naked stone. The wiry and slender Ibon suffered no great inconvenience from the climb, but Morgai, with his sacerdotal girth and bulk, was soon winded. Whenever he paused to recover his breath, Ibon would say to him, "Think of the National Mother," and Morgai would climb the next acclivity like an agile but somewhat asthmatic mountain sheep. They came at noon to a pinnacle-guarded pass from which they could look down on the country of the Edims. They saw that it was a broad and fertile realm, with woods of mammoth mushrooms and other thallophytes that exceeded in size and number those of any other region they had yet traversed. Even the mountain slopes were more fruitful on this side, for Ibon and Morgai had not descended far when they entered a grove of enormous puffballs and toadstools. They were admiring the magnitude and variety of these growths when they heard a thunderous noise on the mountains above them. The noise drew nearer, gathering to itself the roar of new thunders. Ibon would have prayed to Xothakwa, and Morgai would have supplicated the goddess Yande, but unfortunately there was no time. They were caught in a mighty mass of rolling puffballs and toppling toadstools, overthrown by the huge avalanche that had started on the heights above. And, borne with increasing momentum, with vertiginous speed and tumult amid an ever-growing heap of shattered fungi, they finished their descent of the mountain in less than a minute. Endeavouring to extricate themselves from the pile of thallophytic debris in which they were buried, Ibon and Morgai noticed that there still seemed to be a good deal of noise, even though the avalanche had stopped. Also, there were other movements and heavings than their own in the pile. When they had managed to get their necks and shoulders clear, they discovered that the commotion was being made by certain people who differed from their late hosts, the Blemfroims, in that they possessed rudimentary heads. These people were some of the Edims, on one of whose towns the avalanche had descended. Roofs and towers were beginning to emerge from the mass of boulders and puffballs, and just in front of the Hyperboreans there was a large temple-like edifice from whose blocked-up door a multitude of the Edims had now tunneled their way. At sight of Ibon and Morgai, they suspended their labours, and the sorcerer, who had freed himself and had made sure that all his bones and members were intact, now took the opportunity to address them. "Hearken," he said with great importance. "I have come to bring you a message from the god Zilkoig Minzar. I have borne it faithfully on ways beset with many hazards and perils. In the god's own divine language, it runs thus. Iqui Dlosh Odklonk." Since he spoke in the dialect of the Blenthroims, which differed somewhat from their own, it is doubtful if the Edims altogether understood the first part of his utterance. But Zilkoig Minzar was their tutelary deity, and they knew the language of the gods. At the words Iqui Dlosh Odklonk, there was a most remarkable resumption and increase of activity, a ceaseless running to and fro on the part of the Edims, a shouting of guttural orders, and a recrudescence of new heads and limbs from the avalanche. Those who had issued from the temple re-entered it, and came out once more carrying a huge image of Zilkoig Minzar, some smaller icons of lesser though allied deities, and a very ancient-looking idol, which both Ibon and Morgai recognized as having a resemblance to Zothakwa. Others of the Edims brought their household goods and furniture forth from the dwellings, and, signing the Hyperboreans to accompany them, the whole populace began to evacuate the town. Ibon and Morgai were much mystified, and it was not until a new town had been built on the fungus-wooded plain at the distance of a full day's march, and they themselves had been installed among the priests of the new temple, that they learned the reason of it all, and the meaning of Iqui Dlosh Odklonk. These words meant merely, "Be on your way," and the god had addressed them to Ibon as a dismissal. But the coincidental coming of the avalanche and of Ibon and Morgai with this purported message from the god had been taken by the Edims as a divine injunction to remove themselves and their goods from their present location. Thus the wholesale exodus of people with their idols and domestic belongings. The new town was called Glomph, after the one that the avalanche had buried. Here, for the remainder of their days, Ibon and Morgai were held in much honour, and their coming with the message, Iqui Dlosh Odklonk, was deemed a fortunate thing, since there were no more avalanches to threaten the security of Glomph in its new situation, remote from the mountains. The Hyperboreans shared the increment of civic affluence and well-being resultant from this security. There was no national mother among the Edims, who propagated themselves in a far more general manner than the Blenthroims, so existence was quite safe and tranquil. Ibon, at least, was really in his element, for the news which he brought of Zothakwa, who was still worshipped in this region of Sikrinosh, had enabled him to set up as a sort of minor prophet, even apart from the renown which he enjoyed as the bearer of the divine message and as the founder of the new town of Glomph. Morgai, however, was not entirely happy. Though the Edims were religious, they did not carry their devotional fervour to the point of bigotry or intolerance, so it was quite impossible to start an inquisition among them. But still, there were compensations. The fungus wine of the Edims was potent, though evil-tasting, and there were females of a sort, if one were not too squeamish. Consequently, Morgai and Ibon both settled down to an ecclesiastic regimen which, after all, was not so radically different from that of Muthulan or any other place on the planet of their birth. Such were the various adventures, and such was the final lot of this redoubtable pair in Sikrinosh. But in Ibon's tower of black gneiss, on that headland of the northern sea in Muthulan, The underlings of Morgai waited for days, neither wishing to follow the high priest through the magic panel, nor daring to leave in disobedience of his orders. At length they were recalled by a special dispensation from the Hierophant who had been chosen as Morgai's temporary successor. But the result of the whole affair was highly regrettable from the standpoint of the hierarchy of Yaoundé. It was universally believed that Ibon had not only escaped by virtue of the powerful magic he had learned from Zathakwa, but had made away with Morgai into the bargain. As a consequence of this belief, the faith of Yaoundé declined, and there was a widespread revival of the dark worship of Zathakwa throughout Muthulan in the last century before the onset of the Great Ice Age. You have been listening to The Daughter Saturn by Clark Ashton Smith, read by Zabethicus. Original, quote, music, unquote, composed and performed by Zabethicus with the aid of the Fractal Tunesmithy application. My thanks are due to Coda for her invaluable help during the production of this reading. The Daughter Saturn has been brought to you by the Eldritch Dark website, www.eldritchdark.com. The memorial site dedicated to Clark Ashton Smith and his artwork and writings. Thank you for listening.